Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, the Pew Charitable Trust is offering the First Aid some ideas on how to better battle the opioid crisis.
I'm not worried so much about the funding as I am worried about making sure that we have the structure in place, the permanency.
We talked to Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall Long, chair of the state's Behavioral Health Consortium, about where the state's efforts are headed. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about Delaware's efforts to encourage use of living shorelines to battle erosion and sea level rise. Our latest arts playlist tells us more about a long-standing community theater in Dover that's prepping for a new season. And this week's Enlighten Me takes us to the Wilmington Library to talk about its efforts to connect with city kids. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Sea level rise continues to be an issue that concerns the First State. Former Governor Jack Markell initiated a comprehensive look at it in 2013, signing an executive order that created the Cabinet Committee on Climate and Resiliency. That led to a 2014 Climate Change and Sea Level Rise Impact and Vulnerability Assessment that, among other things, forecast a meter or more of sea level rise, inundating 8 to 11% of Delaware's land area by the end of the century. And starting with the Markell administration's subsequent climate framework for Delaware, state officials have worked in recent years to find ways to mitigate that potential impact of sea level rise in the First State. Those efforts continue into Governor John Carney's administration and include something we've covered before from time to time, living shorelines. The state and others are ramping up support of them with a new living shoreline monitoring framework. And we asked contributor John Hurdle to take a look at that and the current state of living shorelines in the First State. His piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to talk about it. Let's start with reminding people exactly what living shorelines are. How do they exactly work?
Well, Tom, living shorelines are lines of natural materials. They're barriers that are set up on the edge of marshes, and they're made of things like coconut fiber logs and recycled shells. Their idea is to stabilize shorelines and protect marshes, and they do that by trapping sediment that's brought in over the top of these barriers at high tide, and the sediment gets trapped in behind these shorelines, and over time it builds up, and then the buildup of silt allows for plants and particularly marsh grasses to grow in those places, and so that creates a little ecosystem which is not only kind of a buffer for the upland behind it, it's also a habitat for various plants and animals.
And why are they often preferable to other options for defending against sea level rise?
Well, the big distinction here is between living shorelines and so-called hardened shorelines. And what we mean by hardened shorelines is things like bulkheads and riprap, which is lines of big boulders that are put along the edge of a shore to absorb the impact of waves. The problem with hardened shorelines, the advocates of living shorelines will tell you, is that the hardened shorelines, they don't absorb the impact of the waves. All they do is repel them. And so one of the problems with that is that the energy of the waves, if they come in and they hit a bulkhead, then that energy can sometimes get transferred to other nearby areas of that shore which are not hardened, and thereby damaging those areas and possibly flooding people's properties.
And you mentioned the idea that it doesn't just protect against sea level rise, it can create these habitats. How big a deal is that purpose for these shorelines, these living shorelines, to create this habitat?
Well, I think that that biodiversity is one of the things that the advocates for living shorelines will tell you, that you know, they want to create the right area for plants and animals to thrive. And there's also an aesthetic aspect here. People who live down at the shore will tell you that they would much prefer to look out on a shoreline that is made of natural materials rather than yards of steel and concrete or wooden pilings that constitute the the hardened shorelines.
There are already some living shorelines here in the first state. Do we have a sense of just how extensive they are locally at this point? Are there a lot of them?
Well, you know, DENREC says that it's really they don't really have the budget to do any kind of comprehensive survey of these things. I mean, they have six living shorelines that they use for demonstration purposes, and there are they know of another four that were permitted during 2017 and 2018, but there has been some surveying done more locally, and I mean, one the overarching idea here really is that living shorelines are actually much less common than hardened shorelines, and on Rehoboth Bay, there's one statistic there that's showing that 16%, 1/6 of the of the total shoreline in Rehoboth Bay is actually consists of hardened shorelines like bulkheads. So we can assume from the statewide picture that the proportion for living shorelines is a lot lower.
And do we have a sense of these living shorelines that we do know about that are being looked at, how successful they are at this juncture?
Well, I visited one of these at the Indian River Marina last week, and that has been quite successful. Now, that is a demonstration project that was installed by DENREC in 2014, and one of the things that's achieved is a growth in the marsh, in the area of marsh, and what that project has shown is that over those 5 years, a little less than 5 years now, the amount of marsh that has actually regenerated is actually 64 square meters. And that's on the basis of a living shoreline that measures 48 linear feet. Now, by comparison, there is, as part of that Indian River project, there's also a so-called control area, where they did not build a living shoreline because they wanted to compare that with the area where the living shoreline was installed. And in fact, in the control area, that actually lost 10 square meters during that period. The other thing to note down at that Indian River location is that that there are outside of the control area is a line of wooden stakes that are submerged, even at low tide. They're submerged about 20 feet from the shore. And the significance of this this line of stakes is that that is the edge of the marsh when this when this project started 5 years ago. So that shows what can happen to a coastline, to a shoreline, in the current circumstances with sea level rising.
And monitoring these current living shorelines is the basis of this new living shoreline monitoring framework that the state's introduced, right? I mean, how does that fit in? What is this framework supposed to do?
Well, it's kind of, as the name suggests, it's a monitoring tool. And so it allows people who have already put in living shorelines to figure out whether they're working properly, whether they're doing things like improving habitat, improving water quality, stabilizing shorelines. And you can view it as kind of a yardstick or a means of judging the success or otherwise of the living shorelines.
And I guess the hope is that the framework will encourage others to look to use living shorelines as they track the level of success of ones that already exist.
Oh, yes, that's absolutely true. I think that the emphasis at the moment is on figuring out whether the existing shorelines are working properly. But of course, when there's good evidence that they are, which of course there is in places such as the Indian River location that I mentioned, then yes, DENREC and its partners are hoping that other people are going to jump on board.
And I found it interesting in your piece that you noted that while living shorelines were often a cheaper option, hard shorelines, as you mentioned earlier, you tend to be the ones that are used more. Why is that?
Well, I think that there's a view among some private landowners that they would prefer to, as it were, set it and forget it, that there's a certain solidity to the steel and concrete and the wooden pilings and so on that go to make up these areas of hardened shoreline, and they can be put in there for, and they may appear to be perfectly stable for 10, 20, 30 years, something like that. Whereas living shorelines, the advocates will tell you, do require some maintenance, and they do require some checking from time to time. So, I mean, that may account for the relative popularity of hardened shorelines, even though they are generally more expensive.
Is a mix of the two, hardened and living shorelines, possible?
Yes, it is. And there is an example of this at the Indian River location, where there's a line of riprap and then probably about 50 yards of marsh between the riprap and the water at low tide. And that area of marsh has been established by the shoreline in that location. And so what effectively you've got is a kind of a double layer of protection for the upland in that place. You have this area of marsh in front of the living shoreline in front of the hardened shoreline.
How optimistic are state officials and some of the other advocates that living shorelines will ultimately have a significant impact on mitigating sea level rise?
Well, I think the first thing they'll tell you is that they would never claim to be able to stop sea level rise. I mean, it's an inevitable process that's going on. But the idea of living shorelines is that they allow the land to adapt to living to the rising water levels in a gentler way than putting up these bulkheads and so on. And the idea here is that by allowing the marshes around Delaware's shores to sustain themselves, they will not only sustain themselves, but they will inevitably move inwards steadily. As the waters rise, they won't be able to repel the waves. But effectively, what they're doing is cushioning the impact and probably delaying the day when the water levels actually get to the upland area.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time on The Green this week. Again, his piece on living shorelines in Delaware is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in just a moment with more on new recommendations from the Pew Charitable Trust on how Delaware can better battle the opioid crisis. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware secured a one-year partnership with the Pew Charitable Trust last summer to develop strategies on how to deal with the state's escalating opioid crisis. Earlier this week, Pew released its initial report based on about 8 months of assessment. Researchers found Delaware tied for the fifth worst overdose rate in the nation in 2017, and less than half of the people in the state who need treatment for substance abuse disorder receive it. Pew put together a wide-ranging list of recommendations, including measures to expand Delaware's substance abuse workforce and make medication-assisted treatment more accessible. Delaware Public Media's Nick Schlino spoke this week with Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall Long, chair of the state's Behavioral Health Consortium, about these Pew recommendations.
I was really pleased today, as you heard all of my colleagues who serve on the consortium with me were also pleased. They took a very thorough approach over several months to interview, to meet with, to listen with families impacted, leaders in our community, systems of care, and in particular address areas of real outstanding need.
One thing that was mentioned is the disparity between Delaware being at the top of the list near the top of the list in overdoses and a lot of bad categories, but at the same time rolling out a lot more policy than other states and doing a lot more with this consortium and other efforts. Is that disconcerting at this time, that you're doing more than other states, but at the same time there are so many overdoses? Last year, more than 400 people.
You know, we knew that going into this a year ago that it would be darker before it was light. I've been saying that for a while. We knew that our report did not get issued. It's not even been a year that our report has been issued. And during that time, as you heard, we've started the first overdose system of care in the country. And all eyes are on Delaware at this time. And that is truthfully one of the reasons Pew picked Delaware, just two states across the nation, to come and work with us, because we had boots on the ground. We have individuals very committed, and whether we're talking about our reforms that we're addressing in our Department of Corrections with providing the necessary treatment, or looking at overall policy, providers, and prescription accessibility to medically assisted treatment, and working with DSAM and Division of Public Health to make sure when somebody needs help, that they get the help that they need when they need it. And again, that gets back to our mental health parity legislation, our Narcan expansion, and so it's a lot of good stuff. And it is probably breath-catching when you look at the number of persons that we have lost. Each one of those numbers represents a life, a person who hasn't fulfilled their dreams. And I am committed, our governor is committed, and I know members of our General Assembly and everyone at this table, the consortium, is very committed to making sure that that number decreases while increasing access to mental health services from our children to our seniors.
You've been able to do quite a lot as far as providing Narcan and beginning the START program, utilizing DSAM grants and some state dollars from the budget as well for the Narcan. But going forward with these recommendations and bringing up things like expanding workforce, what are some strategies looking forward to fund projects like that?
You know, form follows function. And when I was a senator, I sat in the same room here at Buena Vista, and we came up with a whole workforce plan. And it is one step at a time. And I'm really excited that we have some of the brightest, smartest, not only academicians and partners at Del State and University of Delaware, where we can apply for funds and resources, whether we're talking expansion of physicians' assistants who are working hand in hand with our medical doctors or our nurse practitioners working hand in hand. We need to be able to look at how we're maximizing those resources. I'm not worried so much about the funding as I am worried about making sure that we have the structure in place, the permanency, and I'm really excited about it, quite frankly. I think we're in a good place to be able to expand on that workforce component as well as our treatment expansion.
Again, back to the high number of overdoses. One expression you like to use a lot is stop the bleeding. Mm-hmm. As far as just the list of priorities, where do you see the wound is right now? What's the most important thing
to do? I think we continue to do what stop the bleed means is harm reduction in our community. And I think for us, it's getting people the services immediately when they need it, making sure that when I'm out on the street with Dr. Gibney and others from our Access and Treatment Committee, that not only are we delivering the Narcan, which is the antidote to when someone overdoses, but they get that service and those treatment, whether it be a mental health provider that they need to see, and that they have that continuum of care available. That continues to be our number one priority. You are correct that there's a lot that we need to do in prevention. There is a lot that we need to do in education and with vulnerable groups. So we continue to work very closely with our veterans, our homeless advocates, as well as our law enforcement to make sure that we are driving down that number of deaths in our state.
One way that Rhode Island was successful in doing that was allowing medication-assisted treatment in the prison system. Yep. And I know that's something you're already rolling out here in Delaware. There was a call to expand that just now from Pew. Details of those plans?
Yes. I know that our cabinet secretaries have been really closely talking about this, both our Secretary of Health and Social Services, as well as our Secretary of Homeland Security and our Head of Commissioner of Corrections. This is a really important topic. The prison system in our state, correctional system, I should say, is really aware of the need. You heard today data that were provided from the state of Rhode Island, where they talked about 61% decrease in Rhode Island's loss of life from having just the MAT available in prison. So Delaware is looking at that. We've been expanding. I think if you were to talk to our leaders at DSAM and DPH, that is a real priority. And so we're really pleased that they're looking at all three forms of medically assisted treatment available to our prison population.
And back to the workforce, the START program is rolled out. Where are we right now as far as getting peer mentors into emergency departments, and where are there opportunities to do more with that?
Well, you know, I'm a big believer as a public health nurse, the public health nursing professor, it all starts at the street level. It's boots on the ground and having persons who've had that lived experience. So I am thrilled with the expansion to not only peer educators and peer mentors, but the potential eventually to have community health workers. That is a real way of implementing help at the doorstep, helping individuals who've been in that path to stay along a path of recovery. We know that certain models have been implemented, whether we're looking at the Christiana Health System with Project Engage, or whether we're at St. Francis in the ED with Dr. Gibney and her peer mentors from Brandywine. It is absolutely paramount. And so we are excited to continue to look at the value of peer educators and community workers.
Specifically in Sussex County, are there plans? If you looked at that map from Pew, there's big gaps in care down in that part of the state. Mm-hmm. The two programs you just mentioned are Newcastle. What's being done in Sussex?
Believe it or not, I'm so glad you asked that question. There's a misnomer. There are lots of peer educators also in Sussex and Kent who are available to you through different providers. And if you call, Delaware Help is here, as well as, you know, reaching out to my office, we can connect you. Brandywine, who I just mentioned with St. Francis, is statewide. You know, connections. I mean, you name it, we have people available. We have mentors at all levels. And we're really excited today when we heard from the Department of Ed with SAMHSA program, which is funding for our children and families addressing trauma. Governor Carney, you know, has made that whole trauma initiative important to him, as well as his reentry initiative with his executive order. It all fits hand in hand. Peers who've been through the correction system, peers perhaps who have lived with alcoholism, who've perhaps ended up on Percocet, who ended up also eventually using heroin. That matters. And so statewide, we have the access for them.
Okay, last question. Any comment on being named to co-chair the Lieutenant Governors Association right now?
Well, there is two levels. I serve on the board of the National Lieutenant Governors Association now. That is Republican and Democrat. And just was announced this week that I will be co-chairing the Democrat National Lieutenant Governors Association. And it's just a fantastic organization, really focused on what matters to working families.
Thanks to Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall Long and Aronick Shalino for their time on The Green this week. Stay tuned. Art Playlist is next. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Kent County Theater Guild at the Patchwork Playhouse in Dover has produced community theater for Central Delaware for nearly seven decades. And now it's getting set to kick off its 2019 season. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with the Guild's Vice Chair, Valerie Haley, about the Patchwork Playhouse, its history, and upcoming performances.
Valerie, let's talk about the Kent County Theater Guild. What's it all about? Give me some background.
The Theater Guild has been around since 1953. It was started by a group of gentlemen. One of them was an English teacher at Caesar Rodney High School. They felt that there was a need for a community theater. So they started, they had their first board meeting in May of 53, and they immediately started establishing productions. They were held at Caesar Rodney High School, which is now the junior high. In 1973, I believe, 72, they were able to purchase, well, they were given a building, and it was an old Lutheran church. It was then moved to the location on East Roosevelt Avenue where the theater is now. A couple of years later, they named the building the Patchwork Playhouse. So the Patchwork Playhouse is the location, and the Kent County Theater Guild is the organization. We continue to produce plays, and we have ever since the beginning. Every year we have a season that goes from January or February for the first production through usually the beginning of December. This year we have a season that starts in February with a, it had Savannah Sipping Society. The next production would be in May called The Last 5 Years. In July we have Red, White, and Tuna, which is a comedy. Boeing, Boeing is in September, and a production in at Christmas time called Every Christmas Story Ever Told.
Now, who stars? Is it local artists that participate in the Patchwork Playhouse?
Yes. It's volunteers. It's individuals who are interested in theater from primarily Kent County, although we do often have individuals who come down from Kent from Newcastle County and from Sussex. It's the directors are also volunteer individuals who have a desire to direct. Oftentimes, they are also actors.
Is it different directors for each production?
Yes, absolutely. We have a process for directors. People who are interested in being a director can apprentice with established directors and get some experience and then take over directing a production. The last 5 years, which will be produced in May, the director is Kevin Smith. He's been involved with the theater for a long time. He's an actor and a director. Red, White, and Tuna, the director's Patty Gatto, and she is the chair of our board. She is also an actress. Boeing, Boeing is being directed by Nancy Muller, who is the treasurer of our board. She prefers not to be on the stage, but she's very active as stage manager and behind the scenes. And then Every Christmas Story Ever Told is being directed by John Muller, who is also an actor. He was our previous chair of the board, and he's the theater person at Caesar Rodney High School.
Valerie, is it all adults that participate in these productions or students as well?
It's adults and older students, generally high school age and above. There is a children's theater in Dover, so we don't like to infringe on their bailiwick. You know, they produce the programs and the plays with children, for children, so we leave that to them. But we do quite often have high school students who participate.
Are you constantly looking for volunteers?
Absolutely. We would love to have more people involved. If you're interested at all, you can contact us through our website, or that's the best way is to contact us through the website. It's kctg.org. You can start out just coming to board meetings and finding out about the organization. You can audition to be on the stage. You can come to auditions and say, I really just want to work backstage. You can come and work front of the house as an usher or working our snack bar just to get a feel for it. But yes, we want and love volunteers.
The arts are extremely important to the state of Delaware. They're important, really, to the world. How important, in your opinion, is the Patchwork Playhouse?
Well, of course, I'm a member of the board, so I'm a strong advocate for the Kent County Theater Guild. But I'm also an arts person. I'm a musician. I'm an actor. I'm on the board. I'm always very pro-arts. I think art, the arts in general are extremely important to the state, the individuals in the state, as you said, the whole country. Art's been shown to be helpful to students. It increases their ability to do other subjects. It gives people a sense of joy, and if you're involved in the arts, it can give you a sense of accomplishment. I agree that the arts are extremely important in everyone's lives.
Will you be starring in any of this year's productions?
In this year. I focus more music than straight plays. I'll probably help backstage with some of them. I have been in some of the productions previously. We did Sister Act in 2017, which was an extremely successful show. I've been in a variety of other shows at Kent County Theatre Guild.
Now, you mentioned music, so that brings me to this question. The music behind these productions, how does that work? Do you hire local musicians?
We have done that. We've also used recorded music.
Anything else about the Kent County Theatre Guild or Patchwork Playhouse that you want the general public to really know about?
If you're interested in having an opportunity to see quality volunteer productions, we're the place to go. It's also, you know, if you want to have an evening out where you can laugh, you can cry, you can just have an enjoyable evening of the arts, you should come to one of our productions.
Thanks to Kent County Theatre Guild Vice Chair Valerie Haley and our Kelly Steele for their time on this week's Arts Playlist. Information on this year's Patchwork Playhouse shows and tickets to them can be found at kctg.org. And we finish up this week's show next with Enlighten Me and more on the work of renowned artist and children's book author and illustrator Kadir Nelson on display at the Wilmington Library and the efforts to connect area students to it. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. We've recently reported on work from renowned artist and children's book author and illustrator Kadir Nelson being on display at the Wilmington Library, and Nelson's recent visit there to meet with local students. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks to Nelson about his work engaging children and the head of the Wilmington Public Library about that institution's role in the community, especially connecting with kids.
Kadir Nelson's art has been on several covers of The New Yorker, the cover of Drake's album Nothing Was the Same, and is featured in the collection of the U.S. House of Representatives. Last week, he visited the Wilmington Public Library. The artist, illustrator, and children's book author talked to kids about his journey as an artist. He says he comes to public libraries to meet readers of his books in person.
Their children and their parents, and as an artist, an author, I work in solitude, so I don't really get to interact with readers. So it's a great opportunity to get out of my studio and meet people.
Nelson sees himself playing a role in engaging kids with reading.
Children's books is really the introduction of artwork to children. It's usually their first experience with art. And I think we're all visual learners. When kids are young, I think we all really like looking at images that reflect our reflections of ourselves, of our families, our individual stories.
He says he drew lessons from his own journey as a reader.
As a kid, I was not a big reader. I was not really given a lot of or many books that were interesting to me. So, I didn't become a reader until I was a teenager. where I didn't read for fun until I was a teenager. And that's when I discovered that interest-based reading is very important. And I know there are a lot of kids out there that have a similar story, that are not so much into reading. And I think that if I can engage them with the work that I do, with the stories that I'm telling, with the books that I'm illustrating or writing, and help them become a reader, it will enrich their lives in a way that it hadn't necessarily been before.
During last week's event, Nelson showed children from local schools pictures of his art through the years, starting at age 5. He says he tells kids about his artistic development to serve as an example.
I think we as human beings, you know, we're inspired by the lives of other people. You know, if there's someone out there that wants to be an artist, it's great to hear how someone became an artist, what their story is or was, and how the steps that they took. You know, my uncle was an artist, is an artist, and I would learn from him. I learned from my parents. I learned from people that inspired me, like, you know, Michael Jordan or other artists who I admired. We all look up to the people who have to our elders and people who have done it well or before us. You know, that's the only way. We have really great examples. So hopefully my story will be an example to young kids who want to be authors or readers or athletes or whatever path they decide to pursue.
Nelson describes his latest book, Blue Sky, White Stars, as a celebration of America, its people, and its flag.
I think the takeaway from Blue Sky, White Stars is the fact that America is a very diverse place with a very diverse history, diverse people, diverse experiences. And I wanted to create an image of America that I know, that I'm familiar with. I think that we all know that America is a huge family that of people who have come together to create something new, something different, and inspire other people and nations around the world to be the light on the hill. And I think that's hopefully what readers will see when they look in the pages of Blue Sky. They'll see the America that they know and love.
Optimistic and empowering themes run through many of Nelson's children's books.
Well, I think the central theme in the stories that I'm telling through my books, I think the theme is about overcoming obstacles and finding the hero that lies within all of us. So, you know, we have two different sides of ourselves, and I think that once we really kind of step into our own shoes and become that hero, then we can pretty much overcome whatever obstacles are facing us. And I think once children learn that lesson, they can learn that through these types of stories, whether it's with the Negro Leagues or with Martin Luther King, or even Hewitt Anderson's Great Big Life, which is a tall tale. They're all telling the same story, just in different ways. And that's I hope that readers and parents will identify with that, and it will call upon that hero that lives inside of them to kind of remember who they are and what they can achieve and what they can be.
I also sat down with Jamar Romming. He's the director of the Wilmington Public Library on Rodney Square and the North Wilmington Branch Library on North Market Street. Our conversation started with the significance of last week's event. Okay. Like, specifically, why Kadir Nelson?
One thing that you will learn is that in the African-American experience is that art is never done for the sake of art. Art is always utilitarian, and black artists, you know, if you think about, you know, if you look in the arts, you look at Toni Morrison, who wrote The Bluest Eye. And if you read that book for the sake of reading it, you think that it's just a young girl that's going crazy. But really, that book is a good framework for understanding the identity crisis that, you know, that people, that young girls of color encounter, because during the 30s and 40s, Shirley Temple was kind of the archetype of what a young girl should look. And so Toni Morrison in that book, you know, addresses that. So that even though that's just a work of literature, it's utilitarian for understanding a feature in the Black American experience. And so to answer your question, you know, art is utilitarian. So when you look at Kadir Nelson's work, I mean, you might see a boy at the bat, or you may see a lady with the beach ball. But his work, like all other Black arts, it's utilitarian, to where it's a framework for stepping into the interior of the African American experience. And so the role of the public library is to determine what community needs are and respond accordingly. We have a constituency that's majority African American, and we serve children. And so we need to provide venues and avenues to where these kids can see themselves in books and see themselves in works of arts, and to use art as a way to give them a better glimpse of the nuances and angularities of the African American experience. And so somebody like Kadir Nelson is more than an artist. I mean, he is taking us into again, the sociology, the angularity, the vibrancy and richness of the African American experience.
The event we were just at, what was that? How did you put it together? And I guess what was the goal?
Well, the event that we're featuring and exhibiting the work of the legendary Kadir Nelson, who is a nationally recognized artist, illustrator, and who has just done, who's just prolific, who's done great work for Will Smith, Debbie Allen, Steven Spielberg. But the impetus of the event was to, let's go back here. You know, the fundamental role of the public library is to create transformative life experiences for people, and to connect people to resources, and to promote lifelong learning. And in the past, you know, people see the library as a person coming in, you know, and grabbing a book, and that's our connection to resource. But given that, with technology and how the world has changed, how the world has evolved, our role is more or less, you know, we connect people with resources, with experiences. And I think that the whole impetus for having this event was to create a transformative, you know, life experience for the kids, especially, and to compel them to be lifelong learners, and to use literacy and reading as a segue or gateway for upward social mobility. You know, we serve are primarily African American, and over 30% fall below the national poverty level. And so we have a role to equip our constituents, and mainly starting with the kids, to position them to confront a world that's ever changing with technology, to place them in a position to where their lives can be made better.
This event was, you know, obviously there was a book signing element. We saw the art, and he kind of walked the kids through his journey as an artist and how he grew up, and kind of what the factors were. What that's one type of an event you might hold. What are some other types of events that could be fulfilling those same bigger goals that you were just talking about?
You know, again, you know, as aforementioned, I mean, our role is to enhance our constituents' quality of life. And if in order for people to have a good quality of life, they have to be fluent in information literacy. They have to know how to gather information. They have to know how to think critically. I mean, you look at the political polarization, and we can trace much of the polarization to, you know, people are being educated by social media, memes, and the media, and people. We live in, with the information age, people have more information that they've ever had at their fingertips, but they're dumber than ever. And so the library once had a role to, you know, give people books and give people information, but we now have a critical role to ensure that that our constituents are literate, that they know what's authoritative and what's not, what's fact, what's fiction, because they're making decisions. They're going to the polls and they're voting. How do they know that the candidate that they're voting for has their best interests at heart? You know, they can't just rely on a social media mind or a Twitter feed. And so we have a role to make sure that our constituents can be better engaged civically. So one thing that we will do is we will have, you know, town hall meetings here to where our constituents can interact with politicians. We invite our city council people here, our mayor comes here consistently, so that our constituents can interact and engage with them and be well informed. So we have a more well informed citizenry, you know. So the bulk of our work is for the homeless. We provide sanctuary for the homeless in Wilmington. And so we have people that are homeless that they get a reprieve from adverse weather conditions. They come here and use our space. The opioid crisis has, you know, has trickled into here. We've had several people, you know, OD in our restrooms. And so we are, we have to work with our, you know, with our citizens and with our mayor and with other community organizations to address, you know, that epidemic, you know, and that epidemic is here, you know, is here in Wilmington.
So specifically coming off of this event, what else does the Wilmington Public Library have in store?
Well, you know, we're going to continue to figure out what our people need and meet those needs accordingly. We would like to, we're reaching out, we'd like to have LeVar Burton come, you know, next year to do a big event for us. And so that's definitely in the works. We'd like to have LeVar Burton come. And then there's another illustrator named, I hope I get his name right, Gordon James, and he's done a fabulous book called Crowns. And Crowns is basically about a black boy and his experience in the barbershop. And that will kind of be inaugural for our barbershop and books initiative. We're going to have a big launching event in April. There is a gentleman named Alvin Irby, and he's been on NPR, and he has a national initiative to where he goes into barbershops in urban areas, and he does workshops and trainings with the barbers, and he dispenses, you know, he dispenses books like books that Kadir Nelson has illustrated. And those, and so when kids go into barbershop, they get their hair cut, and they get a free book. And so it kind of, what it does, it promotes early literacy. It kind of adds a swagger, you know, to reading. It makes reading cool and makes reading fun. And so that's one thing that we definitely are striving to do is to add swagger to reading. And so we've partnered up with him. So we're going to be bringing that initiative here to Wilmington. And so 30 barbershops, you know, in year 2019 will have a cool display case. And when kids go in there and get a haircut, they'll get a free book, you know. And so we're just trying to sow as many seeds as we can to reap a harvest of a well-engaged and a well-literate citizenry in the city of Wilmington.
That's Wilmington Public Library Director Jamar Romming. And I'm Sophia Schmidt for Delaware Public Media.
Thanks to artist Kadir Nelson, Wilmington Public Library Director Jamar Romming, and our Sophia Schmidt for enlightening us this week. You can find more about Nelson's recent visit to the Wilmington Public Library at DelawarePublic.org. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to everyone who helped make today's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. Crawl and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media. I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.